Welcome to Animal Voices, a weekly show presented through the cooperation of three local societies, Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection, Earth Save Canada, and the Vancouver Humane Society. My name is Marge Adams, and in the studio with me are Alan Jensen, technician, co-host John Pranger, and regular contributor Hazel Smeltzer. On today's program, we'll be covering a variety of topics, including saving the environment, recipes for a healthy living, an animal story or two, and a telephone interview. Our special guest today is Miles Herman, whom we'll be speaking with later in the show. Mr. Herman is an animal structural kinesiologist who practices in the Fraser Valley. He has been helping animals of various species to regain structural health for the last 15 years. The treatment involves gentle, non-invasive manipulation and movement educational technique. Now, Alan, could we have a short musical interlude?
Good afternoon. My name is John Pranger, and I'm going to read to you a news release that was sent to the Prime Minister's office on Saturday, February 3rd, and it was written by Anne Berthessel of the Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society of British Columbia. And she writes that the ADAV Society of British Columbia wishes to record its opposition to the continual funding of the Rick Hansen Foundation without stringent safeguards put in place in regard to the application of these funds. While we wholeheartedly support any initiative to improve the lives of humans living with spinal cord injury, it is in the area of scientific research that much waste has ensued and where a system of public regulation is needed. It is widely acknowledged within the scientific community that the results of animal experimentation cannot be applied to the human patient. Yet the Rick Hansen Foundation is a driving force behind ICORD, whose mandate includes the development of expeditious means of destruction of spinal columns in animal models for the purpose of horrific and to date futile research. One need look no further than the cure for childhood leukemia, which was discovered completely apart from established vivisectionary methods, to see that we are in fact devastating human health by maintaining an erroneous system at tremendous financial expenditure. We urge the Prime Minister, the Minister of Health, and the Canadian public to demand that money delivered to scientific research be directed towards the many non-animal alternatives that are available and have to date provided the genuine breakthroughs unavailable and even precluded by means of animal experimentation. Well, years and years have been spent trying to find a a cure for AIDS, especially in the field of vaccines. And of course, many animals die in that process. And it's all really quite for nothing, and so far there's been very little success, and reports of many injuries on the contrary. And in the first week of January, Professor Francis Miro, who was a lead investigator of a HIV vaccine trial, said that the baby HIV vaccine trial has been successful so far, adding that he hoped the HIV vaccine will be added to the many given to babies at birth and thereafter, like polio, tetanus, hepatitis B, and measles. Preliminary results are expected by mid-2007 in the 2.5-year study. I want to read to you a commentary from the National Vaccine Information Center, Barbara Lowe Fisher. She writes, there are different HIV/AIDS vaccines in various stages of clinical trials in the U.S. and other countries. In the past, evaluations of the toxicity of experimental HIV vaccines were conducted in adults at high risk for HIV infection, such as IV drug users and those with multiple sexual partners. But now children have become the preferred testing ground for experimental HIV/AIDS vaccines and will be the eventual targets for routine vaccination. Newborn infants in Africa are now being enrolled in clinical trials. In the U.S., future HIV vaccine trials will also involve pre-adolescents and babies. A worldwide mass vaccination infrastructure is being created by governments in partnership with multinational pharmaceutical companies, the World Health Organization, and private donors such as Bill Gates and the Catholic Church. During the next decade, an international campaign to vaccinate every man, woman, and child with HIV vaccine will begin. And societal sanctions, including denial of an education and health care, may well be levied against citizens in America and other developed countries who refuse the HIV/AIDS vaccine. What many people do not realize is that the financing of world vaccination campaigns are dependent upon forcing the citizens of wealthy nations to purchase and use vaccines in order to finance the supply of those same vaccines to underdeveloped countries at a reduced rate. For example, hepatitis B disease is prevalent in Asia and Africa, but has never been prevalent in the United States. And HPV, a human papillomavirus associated with cervical cancer, occurs at a high rate in underdeveloped countries without routine pap smear screening, but cervical cancer is at an all-time low in the United States. Still, American children are forced to get hepatitis B vaccine or be denied an education, and the Center for Disease Control has told doctors that pre-adolescent American girls must get HPV vaccine. In 1996, HIV vaccine developer Stanley Plotkin, MD of Pasteur Meilleur Pharmaceuticals, who is a co-patent holder on rubella and rotavirus vaccines, explain why mandatory vaccination in rich countries like the U.S. helped deliver vaccines to third world markets. The keystone of this global mass vaccination system is that the research costs of drug companies are recouped in North America and Europe, and the vaccines are sold in the developing world at much, much lower margins. The relatively high rate of childhood vaccination seen lately in most parts of the world is the result of that system, explained Plotkin. One-size-fits-all forced vaccination policies target the genetically vulnerable for injury and death and violate the human right to informed consent to medical risk-taking. The casualties of mass vaccination policies are never acknowledged or counted in the cost-benefit analyses drug companies and public health officials publish. This will be especially true when the CDC announces every child in America must be injected with just a little bit of HIV virus. I say no forced vaccination anywhere.
Thank you for that, John. Now we're going to turn to Hazel Smeltzer, who has some tips for us.
Thanks, Marge. You know what? The environment is, everybody's getting very concerned now about the environment, and so everybody should be. It's like grassroots. That's my new motto now, grassroots. We have to get down to the grassroots of things. So I've got this some really great little tips on cleaning your house so that you're not using all those toxic chemicals. which are really bad for the environment and bad for yourself as well. So I just got some recipes here. But first, I just want to read the first thing it says here. It says, a good first start is to buy non-toxic cleaning products that won't leave a toxic residue, either on counter surfaces or in the air. So you can make your own cleaners. It's easy, and the ingredients are inexpensive and totally safe. And if you want, you can add essential oils to any of the following cleaners, either to scent or in the case of oils such as tea tree, sweet orange, and lemongrass to also disinfect. However, be careful to use only a few drops. These oils are highly concentrated. Also be sure to include an emulsifier such as witch hazel, aloe vera gel, cornstarch, or vinegar to make such sure the oil blends with the other ingredients. Sounds like baking a cake. So, anyways, I just want to say one little thing. It's a good thing to put all those nice smelling oils in, because I've been cleaning my house for years with vinegar and baking soda, and my house just smells like a pickle factory.
I, too, have used the vinegar and water on the windows for years.
Yeah.
In fact, when I was teaching the Vancouver school system, there was a conversion to vinegar and water from the ordinary sprays for the windows. That was a long time ago.
Oh, yeah. Well, my mom taught me to clean the windows with vinegar and water.
And using newspaper.
And newspaper was the best thing, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Only your hands get black.
That's the problem.
So, okay, here's a little recipe here for all you people out there listening. All-purpose cleansers. And it says, mix one part to one part vinegar in a spray bottle for a cleaner that will also disinfect and deodorize kitchen surfaces. Use borax, a naturally occurring mineral that deodorizes, disinfects, kills fungus and mold, boosts laundry soap, and removes stains. It can be used as a multi-purpose cleaner and an alternative to bleach. However, it is poisonous if ingested, so keep it out of the reach of children and don't use it near food. So here's the recipe. It just says 1 teaspoon borax and 1/2 teaspoon baking soda, 2 tablespoons vinegar, 1/2 teaspoon vegetable oil-based liquid soap, available in most health food stores and in supermarkets with an organic natural product section, or mild fragrance-free liquid hand soap, 2 cups of very hot water. It says the lemon contains citric acid, making it an excellent and versatile cleaner that bleaches, disinfects, deodorizes, cuts through grease, and polishes brass and copper. Use 1/2 lemon as a scrubber, adding baking soda for extra scouring power to get glistening stainless steel sinks and aluminum pots. Baking soda can be mixed with lemon or vinegar to make all-purpose cleaning solutions, or make a paste with water and use it to polish silver.
Hmm.
So that's kind of neat.
It is. Yeah, I'm afraid a bit too fast for people to write down. Could
you
just maybe
Yeah? I've got a really interesting website here that people can look up. Or do you want me to
Good
read?
Good idea.
Do you want me to reread, or should I
Well,
the website?
Well, just read the ingredients.
The ingredients again?
Uh-huh.
1 teaspoon borax, 1/2 teaspoon baking soda, 2 tablespoons vinegar, and 1/2 teaspoon vegetable oil-based liquid soap, available in the health food stores, and a mild fragrance-free liquid hand soap, and 2 cups of very hot water. Mix it all together and put it in a big spray bottle, and you can use that to clean just about everything in your whole house. And one more thing is the drains. You know, like my mom used to always pour the Drano down the drains, which is a horrible, horrible,
terrible
bad thing,
thing
to do.
For the marine life.
So
for sure.
Caustic.
Oh, yes.
I mean, even if you get it in your eyes or your skin or something. Mm-hmm. So, here's another one for your drains. It says pour 1/2 cup of baking soda down the drain, then add 1/2 cup white vinegar and let it stand for 5 minutes, and then pour in a full kettle of boiling hot water. So I have this website. It's www.lesstoxicguide.ca, and I think it would be really great if people would look that up, people that really want to change their lifestyle and do their part for the environment. And also it's very economical.
Yeah, certainly is. I really like the idea of cleaning drains with such simple products, baking soda, vinegar, and water.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
That's right.
Yeah, save the fish and all the other wildlife out in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Good idea, Hazel. Thank you for that.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm. Just one more thing I just wanted to say. It says also, if you don't want to, you know, if you're concerned about all the plastic bottles going into the landfill, using a water filter means you don't have to buy bottled water, which saves money and the planet. Fewer plastic bottles end up in the landfill. And that's a good thing, too. Everybody's walking around, and they buy cases of these bottled waters, you know. And then they even say some of the water you're drinking, it's just some of it's just tap water.
Right. It's no better than what's in the tap, and mm-hmm. probably a whole lot worse sometimes. Yeah, and very costly.
Very costly,
right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that, Hazel. I have a little story here. It's called Pampered Persian. For 15-year-old Kirsten Hicks of Adelaide, Australia, the most difficult part of a long overseas family trip was leaving behind her Persian cat, Howie. In fact, the only people she trusted to look after Howie were her grandparents, and they lived 1,000 miles away. Kirsten was relieved when Grandma and Grandpa readily agreed to take care of Howie for the entire period of the family's absence from Australia. Her grandparents had always liked the magnificent Persian, and they seemed happy at the prospect of having Howie as a house guest. When the Hicks family returned to reclaim Kirsten's furry friend, the grandparents greeted them with the terrible news that Howie had disappeared. They begged their granddaughter's forgiveness and hoped she would understand that they had made every effort to find him. At first, Kirsten tried to nurture a feeble hope that Howie might still be alive, but she knew her pampered, gorgeous Persian probably wouldn't have lasted 5 minutes in the streets by himself. He must certainly have been killed by a car or a dog. Kirsten did not blame her grandparents, but she was heartbroken over the loss of her pet. Back in Adelaide, Kirsten continued grieving for months over her loss. Even though her parents offered, she did not want another pet. A year passed, then one afternoon, Kirsten's mother made an unusual discovery. Lying miserably on the front porch of their house was a stray cat. The long-haired cat was obviously in a bad way. He was skinny, bleeding from a wound in his paw, filthy and very bedraggled. He was also ravenously hungry, as Mrs. Hicks found out when she put some canned tuna down for him. The thought struck her that if they could clean the cat up and fix his paw, he might make a good pet for Kirsten. Maybe Kirsten would accept the cat if she knew that he had just turned up at their house in dire need for help. Kirsten's mother was thinking about how best to clean him up when Kirsten came out of the house. Kirsten took one look at the grubby, foot-sore cat, and then she shrieked, "Howie! Howie!" She went down on her knees and embraced the cat, dirt and all. Her mother was startled. Howie? Was it possible? Kirsten was in no doubt. Underneath all the grime and the matted fur was her beautiful Persian. He had found his way home. Gently, she picked him up in her arms and burst into unrestrained tears when she heard his happy purring. In the 12 months it had taken Howie to make the 1,000-mile trek home, the pampered Persian had somehow forded wild rivers, crossed hostile deserts, and fought his way through the vast wilderness of the Australian outback. He knew where his home was, and neither distance nor danger could deter him. He wanted to lie lazily once more on the soft couches he remembered, and perhaps most of all, he wanted to purr again in the arms of the young girl who loved him so. Such is the miracle of love. That's a story by Brad Steiger from Chicken Soup for Cat and Dog Lover's Soul. Lovely Brad story.
Brad Steiger wrote the story, or he's the editor of the book?
No, he wrote the story.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, all these stories are contributed by different individuals. I thought that was a particularly lovely one. Yes. Now, John, do you have anything else you'd like to...
Here's a beautiful little item, I think. The University of Toronto goes local and sustainable. The University of Toronto recently launched a new program to introduce local and sustainably produced food to cafeterias and eateries serving its 70,000 students. University of Toronto deal brings together eaters at the largest university on the continent with farmers. It brings together eaters with farmers in North America's largest area, 725,000 hectares of protected prime farmland. Local Flavor Plus, the website is localflavorplus.ca, helped set the rules for the University of Toronto and its food services companies and farmers. Local Flavor Plus certified farmers are local producers who ensure high conservation of energy and biodiversity and careful measures of animal and farm worker welfare. Wayne Roberts, project coordinator of the Toronto Food Policy Council, says that these standards go beyond organic certification and address factors such as the distance food travels and labor standards. About 200 campuses across North America, including Yale and Vassar, already have some kind of farm-to-college program. Students on about 60 campuses around the continent enjoy food grown by fellow students on their learning grounds. And that's from the New Farm Newsletter.
Thank you for that, John. You are listening to CFRO 102.7 on your FM dial, and this is Animal Voices. Now, I think we have our guest waiting on the line, so let me just tell you a little bit. Here we are. Miles Herman is an animal structural kinesiologist who practices in Alder Grove and the Fraser Valley. Mr. Herman has agreed to be on the show today and tell us a little bit about kinesiology and what that means, because I think it's a fairly new practice in animal medicine. Now, hello, Miles. Miles.
Hello.
Oh, hi.
Is Marge?
Yes, it is.
Hi, Marge.
Thank you for calling in, Miles.
Oh, thanks for allowing me to come in.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Now, maybe we could start, Miles, with you giving us a definition of kinesiology.
Well, the work that I do is a technique that deals with imbalances in the body, where you can detect them by using a system called biokinesiology or muscle testing. And the base for it is working on the structure, but it's essentially a muscle release technique or involving some joint release, depending on what's involved.
I see. And you do this on various animals, don't you? Is that unusual? I had the impression that this was sort of done on the human species. I didn't realize it was actually used with other species.
Well, I think the thing that's happening now is that people are realizing that you can apply a lot of the information from us as humans to other animals, because a lot of it is, species general rather than species specific. Mm-hmm. And so it is relatively new, more in the sense that people are realizing that it's available, but I've been using this particular technique for over 20 years.
Really? And what kind of problems do you treat?
Well, my base for what I'm dealing with has been horses, because that's what I've been involved with. But I also do some small animal work as well. And the main problems that I'm dealing with are gait irregularities, so potentially lamenesses or, situations where the animal is not moving properly, muscle soreness and stiffness, and sometimes behavior problems that are a result of, the soreness and the stiffness.
I see. Now, how do you determine what is the problem? You don't take X-rays, I don't suppose, do you? Or blood tests and the usual Western medicine type things, or do you?
No. Basically, what I'm involved in is more. I do some gait analysis, so I watch the animal move. Certainly, talking to the owners, because generally they phone me to get a consultation and find out what's going on from their perspective, what kind of problems they've been dealing with, how long it's been going on, and then I do some evaluation based on palpating muscle tissue or muscle areas to see if there's problems, look at symmetry of the body, if there's muscle development on one side, not on the other, and then also use the muscle testing technique or the biokinesiology, which is a reasonably new technique for a lot of people. It is being used on humans as well, but it's a technique where you can be very specific about finding problems because you're detecting changes in the electrical energy of the body.
And how do you do that?
It's a technique where lots of people are familiar with it. If you go to see a chiropractor or a naturopath, they will apply pressure to your arm or your leg and see if the muscle is actually weak or strong. And it's the same basic technique, except you use it on the animals, and I can test through myself to find out if the animals have those kind of things going on.
I've had experience of chiropractors using a small machine.
Mm-hmm.
Do you use any machines?
No, I'm familiar with the machine. There is one particular one that certainly you see some chiropractors use, naturopaths use as well, and it's called a Vega testing machine.
Oh, yeah.
And it operates on the same principle.
It's electric. It operates in finding the electrical output of the area of the body. Is that it?
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. basically designed to deal with imbalances in the body. Because anytime mm-hmm. there's something that's not correct, you will see an imbalance in the body, and these machines will pick it up. But the principle is that our bodies are also capable of picking that information up if you train yourself to do it.
Uh-huh, I see. Now, you treat mainly horses, is that correct?
Yeah, that's been my base for sure, because I was involved with teaching and training professionally in the horse industry for about 30 years and was looking for something other than a bigger stick when the horses didn't cooperate. And once I found out they could be sore, it's like, well, what do you do about it? So that's, that's been my base. But it's, it's definitely transferable to other, to other animals.
I guess there must be a little bit of danger involved with big animals and looking for sore spots, huh?
Some of them generally object, more than others. But usually what I find, I usually attempt to start with them in an area where there's the least amount of soreness or sensitivity, and show them that it's going to be uncomfortable, but it's going to feel better after the fact, and then go from there to the areas that are potentially more challenged, and just generally allow the horse or the animal to let me know where I need to go.
Yes, and I suppose that they can sense that things are getting better, or that you're not there to damage them more, right?
Yeah, most of them figure it out because, they feel that it feels better afterwards, the muscle releases, or they feel less pain, or with the horses you'll get signs like they'll sigh, or we see it in the horses where they lick and chew, and that's indicators that they're getting relaxation. They'll drop their head, sometimes they look like they're falling asleep.
Oh, yeah.
So all of those things indicate to you that feels better.
And what other animals have you treated, other species?
The other ones that I've dealt with mostly are dogs and cats. Those are the main ones that I've worked with, and had some good success with both of those in terms of injury problems or sometimes behavior manifested problems based on injury. Like lots of times you'll have a dog or a cat that will, when you pet them on the back, they'll growl or snap at you, and most people assume that they're being grumpy, but lots of times it's because they're sore, and if you deal with the soreness, all of a sudden you can pet them quite nicely, and they're quite happy with it.
Hip problems, I think, are quite common in large dogs, aren't they? Would that be something you could treat?
Yeah, I've worked on some of them. It depends on what's going on. If it's, structurally based and there are some issues with the joint, not being where it's supposed to be, in other words, being out of alignment, you can deal with it. If there's degeneration in the joint, I usually recommend, that they go see a veterinarian.
Mm-hmm.
And just figure out exactly what's going on before you get too invasive with any, external technique.
Right. I'm sure education is an important part, isn't it, of your treatment?
It's a huge part, and I love it if the owners are involved, want to be involved, and sometimes that takes more time than working on the animals, but from my perspective, it's definitely part of the process.
Yeah, and what about the education of the animal? Is there is some of that involved, too?
Well,
how he walks, for example, which could have some implications, I'm sure, for a horse, thinking of the way he's putting his legs down, or the way he's trotting or doing something. Can you train that, the dog, the animal?
Yeah. One of the things I usually recommend to people, because there's always a bit of a mental component with this kind of thing, and you get the same thing in humans where you can have somebody that's been in chronic pain for a period of time, and you can make them feel 100% better, and they won't move any differently because they're worried that it might hurt.
Ah, yes. Uh-huh.
You get the same thing in animals, very definitely. And so normally that requires some rehabilitation work, either in terms of exercises. I usually recommend exercises over raised obstacles like poles on the ground, or some, you know, mild stretching exercises where you teach the animal they can move and then they learn that it's okay and then they do it, you know, when you're asking them to do it.
Uh-huh. Do you use any medication at all?
No. Basically, what I do, I don't, you know, sell any products or have any products that I give to people. I will recommend products. I tend to stay with holistic or natural products if I can. If there's a product that I know will help them, I'll recommend that they can, you know, go and purchase it from a health food store, or sometimes some other store will stock that kind of product, and then I'll, you know, suggest that they do that. And there are a couple of products you see in the horse industry. One is a product called Bute, which is an anti-inflammatory, and I will the odd time recommend that, but there is some concern with it as far as the lining of the stomach and intestinal wall, that it will tend to create ulcers, so I'm a little cautious about that.
Mm-hmm. And how many treatments would be typical if an animal has a problem? Is it coming back and back and back, or is it something that you can often train the owner of the animal to do? How does that work?
Well, there's certainly exercises that I'll give the owner to do, you know, that will help with some of the rehabilitation process. And I encourage them to work on, you know, keeping the muscles as relaxed as they can with whatever they're doing. Sometimes restriction of exercise, that kind of thing. And a lot of it really depends on the age of the animal, how long the problem's been there, how much you can find out about the history, and then the individual animal themselves. I mean, I've had situations where I worked on them once or twice and, you know, don't hear from them again. And I've had some that you have to deal with, you know, pretty regularly for a period of a year or two. Before you actually, you're seeing progress, but it's either not maintaining or you're not getting enough of a change because of the demands on the animal or because of the seriousness of the injury.
Uh-huh. Now, I know you have somewhat of a background in chiropractic. You just mentioned casually that you had worked in a practice or something. I'm just wondering in my own mind, having gone to chiropractors on several occasions with great success, I'm wondering if there's a commonality between chiropractics and kinesiology.
Well, the work that I'm doing, I actually trained with a chiropractor that was doing this technique in Alberta a number of years ago, and there certainly is some similarities. The work that I do is working on the structure, which is what the chiropractors do, but it's more of a muscle release technique. So it's a little less potentially invasive than what traditional chiropractic does, but I've certainly used traditional chiropractic with good success in the past, and, you know, it just depends on the type of problem that you're trying to address.
Uh-huh, I see. Another question that came to my mind was about the patients. How do they find you? How do the owners find you? Do you advertise? Because I think this is pretty new to most people.
Yeah, I actually don't do a lot of advertising because I'm busy enough. It's mostly word of mouth that I deal with. I've this last year put out one ad in a local horse magazine, and it was mostly so that people could find my number, because lots of times they don't keep the number around. Mm-hmm. And so other than that, I do have a website. It's milesherman.com, and that's MILESHERMAN.com. It talks a little bit about the information. And then I also have an email address, which is miles.h@shaw.ca. And they can get a hold of me there as well. And the important thing to remember is that my name is M-Y, not M-I. So.
Uh-huh. Now, tell us, how does one become a kinesiologist? You must have to have certain background education and training. Could you tell us a little bit on that?
Yeah, the main thing, like I said before, I trained with a chiropractor a number of years ago, mm-hmm. Before it was really popular to do this kind of work. And mostly what I did is he was teaching some courses on it, which I, you know, spent time with, and then I followed him around, so basically did some apprentice work. Nowadays, there are, you know, schools out there that have a background in that information. I just recently had a young student who was a grade 10 that was asking me sort of what they should do, and I said, well, certainly, you know, biology and chemistry are useful from the point of view of having that base, and then you need to know, you know, anatomy and that kind of thing as far as what you're dealing with in specific situations. And then there's different areas out there that will teach the muscle testing technique, and they don't have to be animal-based. You can learn it in any situation. There's one specific technique for humans called Touch for Health, which uses biokinesiology or muscle testing as a base. And once you have that information, then you can apply it to, you know, the knowledge base that you have as an individual.
Aha, I see. Now, John Pranger has a question for you, Miles.
Hi. I had kinesiology used on me as a diagnostic method. Is that principally what it is for you as well, just a diagnostic, and then you know, remedies are whatever they might be, but...
Yeah, essentially it's a diagnostic tool in terms of being able to find problems and then also to recheck to see if you've actually dealt with the problem. And it can be very specific. I find it, you know, more useful in some situations even than palpation or visual observation because you can find things that you wouldn't necessarily find, you know, any other way. But yes, essentially it's a diagnostic tool.
No, I had a kind of a distrust of it because I felt that the practitioner was actually exerting more pressure and rather than my being weaker when a substance or whatever it was that was tested on me. I think it was sort of a diagnostic for maybe allergies, materials that I would be allergic to, or I can't quite remember what it was. But anyway, I had quite a distrust of it because I really perceived that to be the case. And so I couldn't believe it. But with an animal, of course, you're not dealing with a human being who is full of distrust. You know, animals don't have those kind of perceptions. So you can't fake it with an animal, I imagine.
No, you can't fake it. There's no placebo effect. And certainly I was very skeptical when I first felt the technique. I was pretty convinced it didn't work, wasn't going to work.
Okay.
But I've found that it does work and it continues to work. And so... from my perspective, I just, you know, continue to use it. And what I suggest to people is, and this is an expression I heard years ago, and it's that your mind works like a parachute. It's best when it's open. So I just stay open-minded and keep processing the information, you know?
That's a great saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. Thank you, John and Miles. Now, Hazel has a question, John. Miles.
Hi, Miles. This is Hazel. Hi. So I found out about you through the Valley Therapeutic Riding Stables.
Right.
Yeah. So I have a little boy that goes there for therapeutic riding. And can you tell us a little bit about the horses there? Are they a special kind of personality horse?
Well, yes. I've done some work with the therapeutic riding programs in different areas. And this is the first one I've been in with Valley Therapeutic. But certainly the challenges for them are fairly large because they're generally older horses that have, you know, been retired in those situations, so they already have been fairly well ridden or well used, and then the situation that they're in is definitely a challenging one for them because the riders aren't necessarily that well balanced. So they certainly have some issues, but I think they appreciate it, and we've been getting some pretty good success with some of the horses. I just actually received an email from them yesterday, the woman there, Megan, and she had told me that there was one mare in particular that I worked on that was doing very well, and she was quite pleased.
Yeah, because you're getting these horses, and they don't even have any history of their health and their background or anything that they've gone through. And I understand that they've got a horse there now that was a previous racehorse.
Yes, yeah, they have a few, and I mean, some of them are in the process of being, you know, decided whether they're actually suitable for the program, and so you want to make sure they're comfortable to make sure it isn't body soreness that's, you know, not allowing them to do it. But yes, they get a large variation of individuals.
Yeah, so I just want to say thank you for that work that you do there, those horses down there at Valley Therapeutic.
Okay, thank you, Hazel.
Now, do you study, the physiognomy and anatomy of a horse is very different from a man, so it takes a long time to understand a man's, human being's anatomy. How do you need to have a very thorough understanding of other animals' anatomies? And that would be quite a bit of work.
Well, yeah, but I certainly with the horses, I've been, you know, in the horse industry for 30 years, and for me, being involved with the horses was always about anatomy, and I did some certification programs through the instructor certification. They always require that, and I continually read. If you ask my wife, I'm a bookworm. I continually read and look for information, so I'm always...
Sure, it's a passion, eh?
Yeah, yeah, it's a constant process. I don't feel that I've... learn near as much as I'm going to learn, but I've certainly had a good crack at it.
And you say things are not species-specific particularly, but more general specific.
Well, a lot of the information is specific in terms of what you're trying to achieve, and there are small variations in some of the animals, but a lot of the processes that you do are, you know, pretty general in the sense of how things actually function.
Yeah.
Mm, thank you for that. Just before we let you go, Miles, could you tell us a story or two about animals that you've worked with?
Certainly. Yeah, I've had a few that have been interesting along the way. Some a little further back, and one fairly recent. One is a mare, Turkana mare, cross mare that I've been working with fairly recently that had quite a number of issues that were jumping related. But one of the ones was that she was having a lot of difficulty turning to the right. And one of the areas that I work on is what's called the TMJ or the temporomandibular joint, which is where the lower jaw joins onto the skull. And this mare was extremely sore on the right-hand side. And so I did some work on the jaw and you know, released the tension in the jaw and the TMJ. And the mare has been doing, you know, very, very much better. Along with the rest of the work, she's jumping better and everything's going very well. So that's a recent one. And then I have a dog that actually belonged to my sister that injured himself a couple of years ago and was basically not weight-bearing on one hind leg. And I got him along with some homeopathic work that they did to, you know, get him back. So he's now about 75 to 80%, you know, close to normal.
You put a lot of trust in homeopathics?
Yes. Yeah, I've had some good success with it. I mean, it depends on the individual as to who you're dealing with. There can be people that are knowledgeable and those that aren't. But and it's not a, you know, our challenge in this society is that we're used to something, we want the quick fix, and homeopathics generally is not about quick fix. It's about more of a long-term process, and so for some people it isn't as quick as they'd like it to be, but I certainly, you know, like it in lots of situations.
And you consider it to have a sound scientific basis with evidence that keeps you, you know, keep on having faith in that system.
Oh, yeah,
system.
For sure. Yeah, well, and I'm results-oriented, John, so my feeling on it is I'm not necessarily worried if it doesn't seem to work 100% of the time, even if it works 90% of the time. I'd rather do that than say, well, it doesn't work 10%, so it doesn't work at all. You know, that's kind of my theory.
Yeah, well, the beauty of it is, too, that it's non-toxic.
That's right, exactly. Yeah, you can use it, and it's very... You can't over-prescribe it from that perspective.
Now, as I understand the homeopathy, you know, Hahnemann experimented on himself.
Mm-hmm.
How do you come to know a remedy that works for a dog and not a horse, except by trial and error? And how is it possible to even come at arrive at an answer to these questions?
Well, if I'm looking at an in-depth problem, I have a couple of homeopaths that I recommend people phone. For general sort of information, I'll recommend products like Rescue Remedy because that's just an old, you know, a general stress reduction product. I'll recommend Arnica because it's good for strains and sprains and bruises, you know, that kind of thing. But if people are looking for more in-depth information, that's not my area of expertise. And so I just, you know, tell them that it's a good... you know, a good system, and that if they want some more information, that they're, you know, I give them a number of a couple of people that they can consult with.
Now, we have one last question from Hazel.
What about acupuncture? Do you do that, or have you heard of that? I've heard of it on dogs and cats.
Yeah, I don't do it personally. I'm familiar with some people that do it. There's a couple of veterinarians locally that do it with, you know, quite good success. I've had horses that I've been working on that people have used acupuncture on in combination, and it's great from the point of view of, you know, it's more food for thought, grist for the mill. As far as I'm concerned, every little bit helps, and I'm never in a position where I'll, you know, have somebody say don't use it. And like I say, I've seen it work really well in lots of different situations.
Well, that's interesting.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. Now, perhaps, Miles, you could just give us your contact information once again in case people missed it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, would you like the phone number as well?
Yes, that would be great.
Yeah, the phone number to connect with me is 604-309-4616. That's 604-309-4616. That's my cell phone. And then I have a website, which is milesherman.com. That's MilesHerman.com. And then my email address is miles.h@shaw.ca. So that's MilesH@shaw.ca.
I'll put all that information up on our website, which is animalvoices.org.
Okay, excellent.
What about, do you have an actual store address or a practice address?
No.
No office.
I have my van that I drive around in, and I live in Alder Grove, and I have a couple of horses at a local barn there, and I actually get people sometimes to bring their animals to that barn if they, you know, if I can't get to them conveniently. But mostly it's me driving around. That's where I'm headed now. As soon as I'm done here, I'm going to work on a couple of horses.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Miles, for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Marge. Okay, bye-bye.
You have been listening to an interview with Miles Herman, an animal structural kinesiologist who practices out of Alder Grove. Now, you are listening to CFRO 102.7 on your FM dial, and this is Animal Voices. Now, Alan. That was Ponies in the Forest, and thanks to Alan for that one.
80% of medical doctors are unfit. Whoa. That is one of the startling statements of Dr. Edgar Berman, medical doctor, in his bestseller, The Solid Gold Stethoscope. It stirred up the medical men and women and opened the eyes of the public. Many books like that have appeared over time, and yet the vast majority of people never hear it. Dr. Berman was consultant on medical affairs at the White House and was associate professor at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. He enlarges on the subject with these remarks. At least some 200,000 medical doctors practicing medicine today are guilty of incompetence. I estimate at least 10% of these are actually fraudulent and corrupt. And an unfortunately small percentage, certainly less than 15%, are hardworking, compassionate, and moral. The scramble for the dollar shows up in statistics. Approximately 1,500,000 unnecessary tonsillectomies a year. Some 14,000 to 16,000 persons die each year because of the 2 million to 3 million unnecessary operations performed. And God knows how many hundreds of thousands have complications from them. Over the past 50 years, doctors have been implicated in producing more infections, crippling and suffering than all the accidents caused by the combustion engine. Cars, in other words. Plus every illness foisted on the laborer by industry, from black lung to radiation poisoning. Studies at Cornell and Yale have shown that 1.25 million hospitalizations a year are caused by prescribed drugs. And once in a hospital, you still are far from safe. Our hospitals, even the best in the land, produce over 5 million cases of disease a year caused by doctors. Well, I think one of the reasons that doctors have stooped, come so low and have brought the human race to such a low physical status, as witnessed by the people outside the door here in the radio station, which is in the seediest section of town, and it's because of animal experimentation, which is a crime which filters down from the very top to the bottom and is a very strong force in the degeneration of our society. And I want to read a report on a lecture by a Dr. Rudolf Bussmann, a German doctor who was a doctor of medicine and law. And the essay is called Doctor Brutality and Animal Experiments. And he said, the reporter writes this way, Dr. Busman, himself a practicing physician, who runs his practice on a basis of reform medicine, and who studied law only in order to be able to defend himself against the medical hierarchy, gave shattering insights into the present-day practice of the medical training establishments. Almost every clinic and almost every hospital had their own laboratories for practicing animal experimentation. By means of observing and practicing vivisection, animal experimentation, every feeling the young students had for living creatures was systematically destroyed. It was no wonder that any sensitivity toward human suffering and the human contact between doctors and patients also disappeared. The custom of carving up animals like a lump of inanimate matter was by nature necessarily transmitted to the treatment of human beings, who were in many cases no longer seen as persons to be healed, but only as objects to study, or, when they were well-to-do, as sources of income. The Professional Tribune, which was trying to muzzle Busman himself, saw to it, with its draconian fines and its ostracism of those who did not think likewise, that no member of the profession dared to speak out against these gruesome practices. After a few striking words against the daily press, which suppresses any criticism of the medical hierarchy and their vivisection methods, but on the other hand broadcasts every supposed success, which afterwards has often turned out to be a grand failure, diphtheria serum, tuberculin, etc., broadcast these as the greatest scientific achievement, the speaker came to the conclusion that the opponents of vivisection could only achieve their aims by joining forces with the representatives of the alternative methods of healing, which served the well-being of mankind without animal experiments. And that was a lecture that was published in Der Tier und Menschenfreund, which means the animal and human friend, or the friend of human and animal. That was written in 1926. And nothing much has changed.
John, is it true that, or what I've understood from what you just read, is that the alternate medicines, practices of alternate medicines do not use animal experimentation? Is that universally true of all alternate medicines?
Well, unfortunately, it's not very true anymore because people are in university trying to prove alternative medicines by experimenting on animals, which is just the most ridiculous and insane way to go about things. So it's not, and many naturopathic doctors fall into the trap of actually using animal experiments to bolster their arguments, which is a ridiculous practice because, on the one hand, they have a 50-50 reliability of being correct or not, and you never know it until after the fact when you've compared the human reaction to the reaction of an animal that you're studying. And every animal is different, so there's absolutely no chance of extrapolating from the animal to the human being. So, you know, it's pointless to... And in the past, that has been the case. The doctors, the naturopathic professions, homeopaths would not experiment on animals because we're dealing with non-toxic substances in the first place, and we're talking with dietary measures. Mm-hmm. So it has nothing to do with animals. But now, unfortunately, this infection has also settled in the brains of many people who are working in the alternatives field, and
there would not be any government pressure to do that kind of experimentation non-toxic chemicals and so forth.
Yes, so there's absolutely no need to do it.
Yeah.
But people just simply, you know, take the easy way out, and it's a money in your pocket for a 2-year study that any nitwit can do, because anybody can cut up a dog.
Yes, I see.
The difficulty is in healing a human being of a disease that nobody's given him, but which is spontaneously generated. That can't be reproduced in an animal. Mm-hmm. So the naturopathic professions will finally triumph, and drug-oriented medicine will perish.
Certainly alternate medicines are more accepted today than they were, I would say, even 10 years ago.
Yes, and unfortunately, the ruthless medical profession is still trying to mandate drugs and chemotherapies will seize your child, mm-hmm, and imprison you if you don't accede to their demands. And the same with the vaccination question, you see, a compulsion. That is completely unconstitutional, but that's still a battle that's being waged today. So don't think that we are
free of animal experimentation by a long way,
or drug-oriented medicine.
Thank you for that, John. Now we're just about out of time. Well, I'm going to close off now, Alan. And you are tuned to CFRO 102.7 FM, and this is Animal Voices, the show all about animals. So please join us again next Friday, 12 noon, and we'll be back. Thank you.